This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday, March 14th edition of the DRF Players Podcast, episode 220. Could also call it the opening day at Cheltenham edition of the DRF Players Podcast, because I know I'll be having that on in the background as we are live today on Spreaker. A few different ways to follow us live. Probably the easiest way is to just have us on Twitter and follow the links from there. We do a live show every Tuesday and Friday at 11 o'clock. You can also find the podcast at iTunes or wherever your podcasts are downloaded. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, joined today by the usual crew, though, except for me, I'm guessing everybody's not in their... Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, Mike Hogan, I'm guessing, given the state of the weather in New York, this sort of ugly, sort of a disappointment as a blizzard, but still super ugly freezing rain, etc. I'm guessing you are at the Fortress in Forest Hills, not the DRF offices in New York. Am I correct?
You are correct.
I guess that's why I'm recording the pod today, too. I guess I did know that. We also have calling in from an undisclosed location in, I assume, still Planet Texas. You haven't been driven from your hometown by South by Southwest yet, have you, JK?
No, not at all. To be honest, the ride in today was the best it normally is, and the best it could be, because when the University of Texas is on spring break, there's no, it's like the 35, the middle, the highway that goes right through the middle of Austin. There's no traffic. It's great. So,
you get to downtown a little bit despite all the extra visitors in your city.
Yeah. Cause they don't usually have cars.
That's right. How was the MK show on, I think it was Saturday night. I'm looking forward to getting to see your bro live at some point, but I've never yet had the pleasure. How did this show measure up?
It was fun. It was a good time. He gets a little mention every now and then on the podcast, but my good friend and business partner Robert Chow spilled 3 drinks on me.
But anyone, so it must have been anyone, a good party.
Anyone who knows him knows that that's just how he gets down. He's a drink spiller. He just struggles with depth perception after he's been participating in adult beverages. So he spilled 3 drinks on me, but I should have known it was coming.
You weren't wearing like an electric shirt or anything. You didn't have wires or anything to worry about. It was just your garden variety inconvenience, I hope.
Yeah, my feet were a little bit chilly on the way home.
Lots of stuff to talk about. Big weekend of racing. Before we get right into that, though, there were a couple of things from the last show that we wanted to follow up on. I know, Mike, that you had a little bit more to say about this Abel Tasman situation. For those who don't know, Abel Tasman moved from the barn of Simon Callahan to the barn of Bob Baffert. Now, I didn't really buy the reasoning, but who knows? Maybe I don't really know one way or the other. The story going around, I think first reported in the pages of Daily Racing Form, was the switch was made largely because Abel Tasman was wearing the wrong silks in the last race. You give credence to that story?
Well, perhaps. I mean, let's just put it this way. If there is any truth to that story, I could see it being, it's about the silks, but it's not about the silks, if you know what I mean. And I'll give a couple examples. One was, you guys may have remembered in the Derby last year in the saddling paddock, there was a picture that came out of Bob Baffert adjusting or putting on a saddle for Dancing Candy. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
I do.
Yeah, and it was a very odd thing. It actually went around on Twitter, and somebody was like, I wish I had known Baffert was training Dancing Candy. And it turned out that wasn't the case. What happened was Dancing Candy's saddle had slipped or needed an adjustment, and Cliff Sice, who was the trainer at the time of Dancing Candy, didn't have anybody there or wasn't able to adjust it. So Baffert stepped over one stall over. I think more spirit was in the next stall, and he actually did the adjustment himself, okay? Fast forward a few months, and all of a sudden, Dancing Candy's in the barn of Bob Baffert. Now, I don't know if there was a connection or not, but the point being, you're on the biggest day of your racing career, and your owners are there at the Kentucky Derby. And if you're a trainer, you need to make sure that all the little boxes are checked. You need to make sure that you've got people there that know how to saddle a horse in case the saddle comes loose. And if you see something like that and you're an owner, it makes you go, boy, what are we doing here? Let's get with a trainer operation that knows not just the big stuff, but can make sure that they're wearing the right silks or that they have people that can actually put the saddle on in case it slips. Now, I don't know if that's what happened here, but that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to say, I'm still, that doesn't do anything to convince me that that's what was actually going on. It just seems like way too big a decision to make over what, from what I understand, basically amounts to a clerical error. I just don't get it.
Well, you know, I mean, look, training a horse, especially getting him ready, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit with Mastery. Anything can go wrong, you know, and as an owner, you want 100% comfort in whoever it is that's training your horse, not just in the morning, not just the preparation, but all those other details about finding races and spacing works and all of it matters. And so even one small thing can stand out and make you say, well, I don't know if I feel 100% comfortable here. And as an owner, once you start feeling that way, it's probably hard to get back on the train where you're feeling really good about your owner. And it's probably easier to just make a switch to an owner that you do feel comfortable with. Well, here's one other example. This is something I tweeted about. It's maybe like the brown M&Ms in Van Halen. I don't know if you guys know that story, but when I was a kid, I'd heard all these stories about Van Halen into the contract rider. They would not allow brown M&Ms. And if there were brown M&Ms, they had to have a bowl of M&Ms backstage every time they played. And if there were any brown M&Ms, they would refuse to play. And I always thought it was this example of rock star excess, and we can make these demands because we're rock stars and people have to do what we say. And maybe there was a little bit of that, but supposedly the real reason was Van Halen, at the peak of their career, they had all of these light rigs and huge, you know, just amazing shows that took a lot of time and a lot of heavy equipment to put together. And so they buried this little one small, very specific request in the middle of the rider. And if the venue missed it, it made them question all the other things, because if something goes wrong and the light rig falls, it can kill people. So perhaps the silks was about the silks, but it wasn't about the silks.
What do you make of this, Jonathan? Does anything Mike's saying change your mind about the situation at all?
Oh, no. I mean, I think they moved the horse because they feel like the horse is talented and they feel like Bob is better. And Bob is better. And... but I do agree with what Mike's saying. I mean, I think that, you know, it's just an indication of you know, kind of the operation that you have. If you can't get the silks right, are you breezing the horse 5 and you should be breezing them 4? Are you feeding at the right time? Are you doing, you know, if those types of things fall through the cracks, what other things fall through the cracks?
All right, fair enough. I mean, I took it as, look, I'm not saying that it's not going to have a good result for them, or whatever. I think a lot of people, and I had some people call me out on this I was fairly callous, I guess, in my treatment of the old trainer on the show on Friday. And I did have somebody say to me, you know, look, you know, regardless of what's going to happen next with the horse, I guess it was the Maria Burrell joke I made. Maybe somebody thought it was a bridge too far about the complaining about it on Twitter. But the idea, like, you could have genuine sympathy, because I think this game is in trouble. If every trainer just thinks, oh, I'm going to get a better job from a top trainer. That's part of the reason why racing is in, people want to complain about short fields and stake races and horses avoiding each other. These two things go hand in hand. The more you create these sort of uber public stables, I think it's really bad for the game, because I think there's a direct line from that into short fields and non-competitive racing. And so to me, you get somebody, I mean, I'm not going to, based on looking at Abel Tasman's PP and watching her races, I'm just not convinced anybody, to this point anyway, was going to do a better job with her. So if you're, to my mind, inventing reasons to get rid of a trainer who's done right by you and right by the horse, I mean, that is that is kind of rotten. So I'm, you know, that's where I am. You have one more point, Mike, before we actually talk about some new business?
I do. I mean, the last thing I have to say is, look, your owners are the reason why you have horses as a trainer. And, you know, Simon may have felt like it was not a big deal in the silks, but obviously it was a big deal to the owners. And if it's something that's really important to the owners, even if it's not your responsibility, even if somebody else maybe was the responsible for making a slip up, if it's that important to the owners and you know it, it's important enough for you to make sure you're checking up to make sure that the owners are not disappointed. That's the last thing I'll say about it.
That's fair. All right, let's talk about some racing from this weekend. We'll start with the big one, the big cap, Shaman Ghost, posting a buyer speed figure of 108. Mike, what'd you think of the performance?
You know, I think it was good, and boy, it just goes to further flatter arrogant. We've got some good older horses that are seemingly all staying in training, and if they all stay healthy, it should be fun. But he's going to need a big step forward to really compete with Arrogate if he's going to be facing him again anytime in the near future. But that said, Shaman Ghost can win a lot of races against older horses in races that Arrogate's not running.
JK, your pick in the race, I believe, was Midnight Storm. On the Craig figures, on the Timeform US figures, actually pace adjusted, earns the same figure as Shaman Ghost. Does that give you any comfort in your original selection?
Not really. I don't know. I kind of, good for Shaman Ghost. An East Coast horse coming out west and winning a grade one dirt race is always something I think we should pay attention to. I think he's a nice horse, and he showed that in the Pegasus. The problem that I have with the situation is a little bit more. It just reminded me of Banjo. That's what I call Bejarano. It's my nickname for him. Banjo used to do that. That's why he got kicked off of Game On Dude twice. It's because he takes away their biggest weapon and kind of like rates them too much. I just wish he would have opened up a little bit. When I was watching the race and I saw that Shaman Ghost was like a length or two off the lead almost the entire way around, it was obvious to me that was going to happen. So, like I said, many a times, I've never sat on a horse's back other than that time in Puerto Vallarta, on the beach, but I just wish he would open up a little bit.
You feel like a more aggressive ride might have changed the result there of the big cap?
Yeah, no, we talked about this, I think, we talked about it a little bit with California Chrome and the Breeders' Cup. And it's the kind of the first person I ever heard say it was Dale Romans. It's like, if you're going faster, they're going faster too. And when you're running in a mile and a quarter race, when you're not a true mile and a quarter horse and there's a true mile and a quarter horse behind you, you allowing them to stay close to you, in my opinion, takes away your advantage.
But I think that point about it also, though, going faster brings stamina more into play. I do think there are instances where, certainly many instances, where a horse cedes the advantage of being a front runner by going too slow. I hadn't had that thought about this race, and I do think, given the limitations potentially distance-wise that Midnight Storm had, you got to take that into account too. You're trying to coax the mile and a quarter out of him, maybe, and the faster you go, the more that's a difficult thing. You'll see that all the time. Horses going slower early when they're not sure. You can essentially make a mile and a quarter race a mile and an eighth if you could be in a high canter for a couple of ace or maybe even quarters there. So I'm not sure I fully buy in this instance. While I think that's an interesting argument sometimes, Jonathan, what do you think, Mike?
Go ahead, Jonathan, and then I'll try.
Yeah, just real quick. I just feel like maybe you're right, but I think that if you had to ask me which one is more likely, is Midnight Storm going to win the race on the lead, going a mile and a quarter with Shaman Ghost never being further than a length and a half off of him? Or is Midnight Storm going to win the race when he's clear going fast and he's three clear the entire way? I would think that he's got a better shot of the second one. The first one, I don't think he'll never win that.
We've seen how the first one plays out. So in that sense, right, what you're saying is indubitable. I'm not sure that he wins that race, period. But what do you think, Mike?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's the kind of thing where if they ran the race three or four times, Bejarano would try three or four different ways to get that extra mile or extra eighth of a mile or quarter of a mile out of Midnight Storm. He might do like Jonathan's suggesting. He might a couple times try to conserve some energy and kick late. And I think most of the times he's just going to end up finishing second to Shaman Ghost, and it's going to be very similar to what we saw. I mean, I get your point, but I think it's more a case of maybe next time they try something slightly different because this time they were just trying to coax that extra distance out of him.
All right, let's talk about what many would have had as the headline story of the whole weekend. Certainly a shakeup in the Triple Crown trail for Jonathan Kinchin, and then there were zero. Your second now, excellent value, 100-1 Kentucky Derby future bet, unfortunately, not going to be making the starting gate. Mastery, extremely impressive visually, ends up taking a bad step. Mike Smith showing excellent horsemanship, jumping off shortly after the wire to attempt to minimize any damage. And it sounds like this is not certainly not a life-threatening injury. It is not even necessarily a career-threatening injury, except in terms of timing and what Mastery has already accomplished on the racetrack. Take us through your emotions, Jonathan, watching Mastery, and then give us your thoughts on the race.
Well, my brother was there, and he obviously knows I'm into racing, but doesn't share the same enthusiasm. He's been in the track with me a few times. And they cross the wire, and I look back, and I'm like, Mark, I know you don't understand this, but this horse is going to be the favorite for the Kentucky Derby, and I have 100-1 on him, and if he wins, we're going to win $25,000. And he's going to be like the horse that's supposed to win the Derby. And then I looked back, and Mike jumped off, and I was like, oh, geez, I should have knocked on wood or shut my mouth.
And at that point, of course, concern shifts to the horse. I mean, you don't know at first what's going on there. Thankfully, not as bad as it looked there for a second when you knew he was going to be vanned off. The early reports were able to make us focus back on the betting side of the equation rather than having to worry about his safety. But, I mean, how good was that? A 105 buyer speed figure, the first truly fast Derby prep, really. The first one that I, in the little final time evaluation spreadsheet I'm doing, I have as a fast in the second column. And right, you're thinking, there goes, it's such a rough mixture of emotions you'll see in this sport going from, I mean, as much as you felt that way, JK, imagine the connections and what they're dealing with in those few moments. How good was this race?
Yeah, I mean, you know, another Bob Baffert horse ran a 105 buyer in the first Saturday in May, and he was pretty damn good in American Pharoah. So, you know, here's the thing. Obviously, in racing, where this is a very selfish sport, you're thinking about yourself. And moments after I got over my own agony of $125 since I shared that bet with a friend, I thought to myself, you're ridiculous. Imagine how it feels to have owned or trained that horse and the disappointment that they must be feeling right now. And it's pretty heartbreaking. Thank God the horse is going to be okay in terms of living his life. But it's just a sad thing. And it's sad for the owners. It's sad for everyone. It's sad for the sport. It was going to be exciting. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Escondrea, obviously a little bit closer to the race, but how promising he was as a horse and us not getting a chance to see him run in the first Saturday in May. A little bit the same with Uncle Mo. Not that suggesting Uncle Mo was going to win the mile and a quarter Derby that day, but and it reminds me of another future bet that I had, which might tell people that I need to stop making future wagers, which is I had a future wager on I Want Revenge, and was sitting at a Bob Evans in Louisville, Kentucky, when a friend texted me that he had scratched the morning of the Derby.
The Kinchin Curse, we're going to start calling it. You get 100-1 on a horse. And have you cashed any of these? Are you, you know, Matt Bernier famously did cash his massive price on Orb a few years ago as part of his ascent into his racing fandom. Have you had any, do you have any future book successes, JK, or are we going to pretty much just keep you away from the windows in Vegas?
Yeah, keep me away. But, you know, I don't do it that much. Like I Want Revenge. I took a pretty long break. I did bet some exactas. in the Derby, the actual Derby Parimutuel pool for at some time. But I never really cashed any of those. And then I took a long break until this year being out in Vegas or not being out in Vegas, but being able to get it down in Vegas a little bit. So no, I'm going to retire again.
That's one of those things, JK, you know, you might be a degenerate if you've been a future book exacta, because the regular future book just doesn't hold enough risk. You got to get the 1-2 finishers. Mike, this race was, I think we've covered the winner pretty well. What about the horses in behind Mastery? Is there anybody coming out of this San Felipe you're going to be looking at going forward as someone you're interested in for betting purposes?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, the top ones, we can talk about all of the early favorites of the Kentucky Derby. Since the future pools, basically since it turned to 2017, I mean, Classic Empire, he's a huge question mark. He's finally back to the work tab, but he's going to have essentially one prep prior to the Derby, and he's a big question mark in my book. For a minute, Irish War Cry was one of the favorites, and off that horrible effort in the Fountain of Youth, I think that opens the door for others. McCracken, seemingly, we'll talk a little bit about how Taprit essentially flattered McCracken in the Tampa Derby, but McCracken
not just Taprit.
Had that. Well, not just Taprit, right? Exactly. All the runners of the Sam F. Davis flattered McCracken, but McCracken had that small setback. And anytime there's a setback on the Derby trail, it makes you wonder, because it's so tough to win the Kentucky Derby, and it's so tough to prepare a horse to get ready to run the furthest that they've ever run against 19 other rivals. So there's a lot of question marks. And I was with Jonathan. I mean, I wasn't physically with Jonathan, but I was thinking the same way as Jonathan. As soon as Mastery crossed the wire, I said, there's your favorite for the Kentucky Derby. I even tweeted it. And then after Smith's off, I deleted the tweet, because I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I was worried for the horse. Thankfully, it sounds like he'll be okay, but it certainly opens the door for any of them as possibilities. I don't know if Iliad is the one that steps forward. I don't necessarily love him stretching out and getting 10 furlongs, but maybe. I mean, for me, it's kind of McCracken if he's right, and we'll find out soon enough in the Bluegrass. I've mentioned Epicharis, but I think it does, or Epicharis, it does open up the door for something crazy like a horse from Japan.
Put a pin in that, because we have a question about it, but I did just want to, before we get, I'll jump and I'll put that question in now because it goes here. But I did just want to say the gallop out, one thing I noticed, my eye was just drawn to it, term of art, galloping out very well in that race. Is he a horse? I haven't done any additional work. If term of art's the kind of horse where, if some other factors line up, is maybe an interesting horse to come running late in a race like the Kentucky Derby, maybe. I just have a little note to self to do a little bit deeper digging on that horse and take a look. Because I could see a scenario in which, let's say he were to run back in the Santa Anita Derby and maybe not get a setup and still run third or fourth, and then the Derby shapes up to have a fast pace. Just that kind of horse, thinking about probably almost more for third and fourth, but just one other note I made in that race. But this question we had, Mike, ties right into what you were just saying. It was about Epicharis, and it was a question of how to evaluate him, asking if and how you might use Lonnie as any kind of benchmark for him, and saying, with all the chaos on the Derby trail, is he worth a long look at this point? What do you think? What's the answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are crazier plays. And I mean, last year we had, you know, I know there were some people that questioned Nyquist, but he was coming into the race as your 2-year-old champion, and he was undefeated, and he had vanquished some of the other more sexy Derby picks and Mohamed and a few others. So he was proven, even if you felt like there was a knock against him, he was still a legitimate favorite. And Lonnie, with his running style, where he was, you knew he was going to be way out of it from his previous races, with his odd training regimen, with a number of the other questions, he just seemed like the gap between Nyquist and Lonnie was pretty big last year. And that said, even it took to the Belmont, but he ended up validating that the form was not horrible. Compare Lonnie to Epicaris. Where they were at this time last year, Epicaris finished fifth in the race. Or sorry, Lonnie finished fifth in the race that Epicaris just won recently. Epicaris is taking the same path. He's going to go to the UAE Derby. We'll see how he does there. But if he runs well, and if there are still a lot of questions in the North American runners, I don't see why he's not a player, especially considering his running style tends to be more of an American-type running style. He's a speed horse or a stalker. He's not a deep closer. He's not one that's going to be necessarily up against it from a pace standpoint.
Certainly, if you look at the time form figures, Epicaris, as you say, Mike, way ahead of where Lonnie was. JK, you said when this horse came up in an earlier edition of the show that for you it was going to be all about the workout reports once the horse arrives on our shores, as well as how he handles himself in his final prep race. But given the chaos we've seen over the last few weeks in the Derby prep races, can you say, are you more interested in Epicaris now, or are you still sort of in total wait-and-see mode?
Yeah, no, I'm in still total wait-and-see mode. It's still such an extreme disadvantage, in my opinion, to come over here and to adjust to our style of racing and blah, you know, all that stuff. I think it's just a disadvantage. So, no, I'm still wait-and-see with him, see how he runs in Dubai. And then, like I said, once he gets over here, to see what the workout reports come back on him. But it would have to be a really tricky situation in which I would ever pick that horse on top.
While we're talking about three-year-olds, let's go a little more in depth on the race that Mike was talking about before, the Tampa Bay Derby, aka the McCracken Form Boost Derby, where, what was it, the horses that were 2-3-4 behind him came back to run 1-2-3. They were led by Taprit, earning a 96 buyer speed figure. Many, including myself, thought things lined up beautifully for Taprit in this spot, but I have to say, was a little surprised at the exuberance in the betting markets for Taprit. He gets the job done. It looked flashy, prompting some folks on Twitter to start beating the drum of him as an emerging star. But, you know, the figure comes back as a 96. It's slow for this type of race. It, from my opinion, it makes it a little tricky to get too excited about him going forward, simply because there's obviously a lot of market exuberance for him, and yet he's still got to improve in terms of his final figures to have an impact in a race like the Kentucky Derby. Of course, maybe there's a lot of horses in that position. I don't know. For me, if I'm going to be betting on a horse who doesn't stack up on figures, I want that horse to be a long shot, not looking like Taprit will be anything of the sort. JK, what did you think of the performance on Saturday and the Tampa Bay Derby in general?
Well, I think this is one of those situations where moving forward, I never can get enthused about playing a horse like this afterwards. That situation is that, like, when you look at a race and you're like, okay, Taprit's going to be extremely overbet in this spot off of the last performance and the seeming, whether you agree that it was or wasn't a trip, I was kind of on the – I leaned more that it was a trip, man.
Race. Right. He struggled to get a run while the other horse was clear on the outside. I give him that. If nothing else, I give him that. That was a tough trip the race before.
Right. And so when that happens and you see a horse, you're like, oh, this horse is going to be extremely overbet in this spot. He's probably better than these, but I can't take him at this price. And then that horse wins. Then I really, really, really don't want him the next time, because then it's just going to be even more magnified. He was already a shorter price than he should have been against a field that obviously he was better than. I'm not interested in him out of this race. He's one that will have to show up to Churchill and be working a hole in the wind for me to use underneath of tries and supers, but nothing he's done on the racetrack yet makes me say, oh, that's one that I'm definitely going to key or use on top.
In the Kentucky Derby, you mean?
Right, right. I'm sure he'll run again, right?
I would think. I mean, Destin didn't, possibly.
Yeah. I'm sure he'll run again.
Have you heard any
because
plans?
Destin's owners were Sheets guys, I think.
Have you heard any plans, Mike, for Taprit? And what did you think? You talked a little bit about your thoughts about this race before, but anything further to add?
Well, I have heard, I believe, we haven't mentioned Jay Privman on the show yet, so maybe we can fix that. I think Jay wrote an article after the race. I'm trying to pull it up right now. Saying that Baffert may run Taprit once, likely in the Florida Derby, before the Kentucky Derby. I don't think it's a definite, but he said he came out of the race in good order and another start is possible. So we'll see. I'm kind of with Jonathan on this. I don't think the winner was in Florida Derby. I think it really just did make McCracken's absence that more of a big shadow hanging over the race, in my opinion.
That's a great point, and something, you know, I'm talking about it like there isn't a clear favorite or it's so confusing. Right now, yeah, McCracken just looks awesome. I mean, that's
he does. The only real knock is that question. You know, supposedly he only missed a few days of training, and Wilkes came out and said, well, you know, we could have gone into the Tampa Derby. It wasn't so bad, but since he's got the points, there's no need to rush it, and he got enough out of the earlier race. You know, I think it was just erring on the side of caution, which I absolutely applaud, but
I never expected him to see him in there. Like, I'm not saying that it wasn't a legit setback and they didn't really want to go in there, but I was sort of all along, you know, we had that discussion on the pod about Street Sense and what his PP looked like heading into Louisville, and I was really wanting the exact same thing from McCracken, and that having that start before the Derby in the Bluegrass, that's what I was always anticipating. So I'm not – I get what you mean. A lot of times – there's a deviation from the plan, I will sometimes see that as a negative, more probably than most horse players. But for me, I just it's sort of shaping up exactly how I want to see it shaping up for him.
Right.
JK, where are you with McCracken? Are you if you were to give? I mean, I guess you'd almost, well, I don't know. If you had to make a pick today, just a pick, no odds, just pick the most likely winner of the Derby. Are you happy going McCracken at this point?
No, not at this point. But I'm fine with the situation. Here's how I would look at it. Is I'm going to be against him in the Bluegrass because he's going to be extremely overbet. And then if he proves me wrong in the Bluegrass, then I'll jump on board for the Derby. But I need to see an effort out of him before I jump back on board.
Well, wait a minute, Jonathan. So McCracken probably, I mean, I think you're right. He'll be the favorite in the Bluegrass, but aren't a lot of people still going to be betting and giving the mulligan to Classic Empire?
No, not after.
You don't
think?
Really?
No, we can future. I told you I was retiring from future betting. We can future bet who's the favorite now for the screen, the avatar, if you want to. It's definitely going to be McCracken.
Of course. I'm just saying all things being equal, won't Classic Empire take a bit of money to the point where McCracken is not necessarily going to be odds on?
Yeah, he probably won't be odds on, but he'll be shorter than I would like for him to be off of a horse who's missing works, the same as Classic Empire. That's why there was going to be so much value in that race, is those two horses are going to be so overbet off of situations in which you don't want to bet horses on a Triple Crown trail. There's going to be a horse like Jay Boyce Echo who's going to come off of the greatest stakes win in the Gotham, who's going to be, you know, 7-1 in a spot with those two horses.
Did you have
I tweeted out, well, I don't know if you saw, I've been tweeting it the last few weeks, kind of almost as like a little joke about making Derby contender lists at this point in the year. I've done it a few times, and the one I did yesterday was my current Derby top 10. Number one, whoever Bob Baffert sends to Oaklawn. Number two, McCracken. Number three, the Japanese horse. Number four through 10, pick 'em. And it was a variation similarly in the previous weeks. But I'm still kind of on that. I want to see what happens at Oaklawn in the Rebel before I make my decision about whether it's McCracken or whether it's, could be American Anthem. Could be even another from Oaklawn. I think that's going to be an interesting race, and that's always proven, at least in recent years, to have some strong contenders in it.
American Anthem was the one who tangled with Gormley, right?
Yes.
Does that lack of form boost concern you, Mike?
No.
Jonathan?
No. I actually responded to a podcast friend and occasional guest, Marcus Hirsch, who said that, you know, he suggested that Gormley's performance kind of makes you think twice of, well, I don't know, I don't want to paraphrase, but, you know, it was essentially a negative towards American Anthem. And my answer was that race took place on a wet track with, which I think most people will remember, Paul Matisse talking about the advantage of being on the outside in a slow paced race. That's a perfect example of that. Gormley was on the outside while American Anthem was on the inside. So I can care less what Gormley does moving forward from that race. I'll give American Anthem another shot.
It doesn't make me feel good. I'm not saying it's like the death knell for the horse's betting chances, but it doesn't. I think I'm taking it a little more seriously than you two guys, but not, you know, again, not to an extreme point, but it's a negative data point for me. I'll say that much.
Here's why it doesn't matter to me. This was a horse who was making his first start against winners, his first start going two turns. He dueled against a horse that was already a graded stakes winner. He lost the lead and rallied back along the inside, which, as Jonathan has mentioned and Paul mentioned, that is those outside horses, when they sweep past, you almost never see the inside re-rally unless there's something weird going on with the track, which for all instances or all indications, I don't think that was the case there. It just showed that this was
a weird racetrack, honestly.
Maybe. But
I'm not saying it was or it wasn't, but it was a – remember, that was like a – it was a really strange day. But
yeah, it was. I'm just saying of those trips and of that race, I mean, regardless of the other factors, which is a horse making his second career start and his first time routing, his first against winners, even if you put that aside, I want American Anthem out of that race. And yeah, if Gormley had run really well, then it sure does boost him, but it doesn't take away, in my opinion. I had already wanted American Anthem anyway.
All right, well, lots going to be shaking out. When is the Rebel?
Is it this weekend?
It's got to be,
or is
soon,
it next
right?
weekend? Because, I think it's this weekend.
The Arkansas Derby.
No, I'm pretty sure it's this weekend.
Yeah. I think we just had one of those classic this weekend, next weekend mix ups. It's the next Saturday that happens is the race. I'm pretty sure.
This weekend is the Rebel. Next weekend is the UAE Derby, and then we get into the bluegrass and all that sort of stuff.
I'm excited about my debut at the Arkansas Derby. My trip is shaping up nicely. A lot of friends have reached out, are going to be around, so should be a really good time. And obviously the Rebel will offer some major clues to what's happening there. Let's talk about a couple other races from the weekend, guys, starting with the Triple Bend. Gee, I guess it's a good thing that first level allowance didn't go for Denman's Call, huh, Jonathan?
Wow, yeah. Well, what I was thinking is Dortmund would have won that race for fun if he would have ran in that one instead of the turf try that I was questioning prior to the race.
Yes, that's not a red board. You did say he's very funny and astute comment. 0-1 in picking spots for Dortmund. I think that's a reasonable assumption. Do you agree with it, Mike, that Dortmund wins the Triple Bend if he's entered there?
I guess so. I mean, we'll see. He hasn't won.
Humorous, Mike. Much more fun if you argue.
It's not as if Masochistic or Denman's Call didn't show up. They both ran the race. Denman's Call ran the best race of his career, and maybe this is just as a 4-year-old now, a horse who's kind of coming into his own. So I don't know. I get the point. I understand. All things being equal in terms of the back class, Dortmund is probably better than all of them. But I want Dortmund to prove it to me before I'm taking him as a winner of any race going forward on dirt, two turns, one turn.
He's never lost going one turn.
Well, how many times has he gone one turn and how long has it been?
Twice, but I'm just saying I've always wanted to bet him against Run Happy when they were going to run in the Malibu so badly and then he scratched. I just think he's going to excel at one turn as a big, big horse. I think that if they can get him going in the right direction, he'll win the Met Mile if they can just get him going in the right direction.
Well, I think that's the point. That's the key point. If they can just get him going in the right direction and just he's the kind of horse by name, by previous accomplishments, he's going to take much more money than he probably should in whatever spot he's in. I mean, Saturday's race on the turf showed it. Wasn't he the favorite for a little while?
I didn't notice that. Buyer's speed figure for Denman's Call was a 104. Right, it's not like Denman. The way JK and I are talking, it's as if Dortmund routinely runs 110s. It's not like he had to run a 104. Should he have run in that spot? My gut just tells me at hindsight 2020, I guess, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with that horse next. Has there been anything officially reported on it, Mike, that you've seen?
Not that I've seen, but I got to imagine they're just excited about him as a potential sprint candidate out on the West Coast now. And there's a lot of options for a horse like that, especially since Dreyfong's going over to Dubai, and you know, there's some other of the good sprinters are going overseas. There's got to be a few opportunities for him.
Bala Bali wins the kill row with a 102 figure. The old master Mandela getting the job done. What were your thoughts on that race, Jonathan?
You know, for people that follow the workout reports in California, you probably feel the same way that I feel, is that like Bala Bali was like, he for a long time he was always getting unbelievable workouts. Like, I mean, just like that he was like the next coming, and then he would always just kind of underperform. So maybe whatever the situation was, they got it straightened out, and good for them. That's always fun to see Calumet with a good horse, and I didn't really realize it was fun to see that until I got a chance to kind of check Calumet out, and then I started reading that book that we talked about, that book Wild Ride. Yeah, I started reading it. So and I actually started reading it like right before that, you know, the day before that race. So it was kind of exciting to see Calumet with a win.
Are you digging it so far? Tell people a little bit about the book.
Yeah, it's a story essentially about how Calumet was pretty much the premier, you know, owner operator breeder in Lexington, Kentucky for the longest time, and how they just were just a huge part of the economic situation there, and how one guy kind of did some shady business and kind of started to fall apart. And the biggest piece of the puzzle is how and why and if Aladar was killed accidentally, or if it was somewhat intentional for insurance purposes. And so that's kind of what the main idea that I've gotten from the story is, at least so far.
It's a murder mystery. Do you have the author's name in front of you? Do you have the book in front of you? I feel like she deserves some.
Yeah,
credit.
I do. Let me see.
Anne Hagedorn, right? I think it just
Anne Hagedorn Auerbach.
Yes. Yeah. That sounds right. That sounds right. I haven't looked at that book in a long time, but that's cool. Always like to give the authors a little bit of a plug on the podcast when we can. Mike, your thoughts on the kill?
I wonder why. I wonder why you appreciate that.
it's interesting to me. I tweeted it out before the race. You know, Bala Bali was on the Calumet Farms stallion roster this year. $10,000 stud fee. I don't think he's covered any mares. I don't know if he's going to cover any mares. But supposedly Mandela said, look, he's actually training pretty well. Let's keep him in training. I think we can win some more races. If the guy wasn't right. And Bala Bali's proven he wants a flat mile. He's done his best running at a flat mile. And there's some question marks, I think, with the milers right now. I mean, it's been a while since Teppan has worked. I don't know what's going on with her. Maybe the door opens for a nice older horse like Bala Bali to stay in training one more year and win a lot of races at the mile distance.
The stud fee certainly went up, I would have to surmise based on that.
Mandela, absolutely.
It's one of those trainers, and there's a few of them out there, but one of those trainers, especially on turf, but almost anywhere, where I'm just happy to sort of respect the master and use the horse whenever I can. Definitely one of the guys I really like, who clearly does right by his horses, and always good to see him in a big grade one winner's circle photo. Let's move to the Honeybee. Mike, you mentioned that this was one of the races you were interested in watching over the weekend. What are your thoughts coming out of it?
Oh boy, I was, it was a little bit of a head scratcher. Elate was the horse I think everybody was interested in. Of course, she was the favorite. She wasn't as legitimate or as overwhelming a favorite as she was in the Suncoast. But she was a clear favorite, and I guess she ran on well. She lagged way behind early. Maybe it took a little while to get her in gear, but I don't know if any of the Kentucky Oaks winner is coming out of that race. The winner was It Tis Well. She certainly did very little other than flattering Unique Bella. And I think the angle of horses moving away from Southern California to win graded stakes races when you've got a horse like Unique Bella there, I think that we're going to see that quite a bit this year. But it was a good race. I think those are probably the two I'd be most interested in. But it's going to take an issue, I think, for Unique Bella for any of them to win the Oaks.
What do you think in terms of what happened to Elate on the day, JK?
Yeah, I mean, she had a tough trip. I mean, I thought I played her in tournaments because I thought she was going to get such a big setup and I was going to give her another shot. There was just so many horses that wanted to be forwardly placed. But she had a little traffic at the top of the stretch. It felt like, you know, it's just weird. I guess I'll give her another shot just because I wasn't overwhelmed by anyone else in that position, in that spot. But one of the interesting points that Mike brought up that kind of got me thinking is, and I hate to shift gears like this, but I don't want to forget, what is this thing with Mastery being out now do for the prospects of Unique Bella running in the Santa Anita Derby?
You would think it would enhance them.
I mean, if they're interested, right? Yeah. Yeah, sure. I guess. I mean, it again goes back to why the connections were not considering the Derby Trail. Is it because they were worried about some other horse, or is it because they were focused more on what they wanted to do with their horse? I don't know.
Well, let's finish up with the Honeybee. I agree about the trip on Elate. I thought that was an excuse that I would give another try. Problem with that race, though, and I think this leads into what Mike was saying about it, 87 buyer speed figure, not exactly times that are going to make Unique Bella quake in her stall. So you do have that. You do have that on the downside.
I mean, the thing with Elate, yeah, I guess it was a trip, but the problem was she was lagging so far behind.
She didn't break.
You know, with and then it took a little while for her to get into stride and I don't know. These deep closers, maybe you forgive that race and say, okay, look, if she breaks more sharply, she's probably better than that. But this is a horse that's now been beaten and well beaten at short prices going forward. So for me, it just kind of comes down to a price question. If you're able to get a price on her, sure, she's got talent, but so far she's been quite a bit over bet.
Yeah, the Royal
maybe Delta. Later. Maybe Oaks Day when it falls apart in front of her, going a mile and an eighth. I could get a little bit more interested. She was running on late, so.
Yeah, the Royal Delta comparisons have proved to be a little optimistic, let's say. But
yes.
There's definitely some talent there and a horse who's not off my certainly a horse I'm interested to see what she does next. The last specific race we wanted to talk about was the Florida Oaks. JK, you nominated this one for our little rundown. What did you have to say about it?
Well, I just thought it was interesting. I think that it was a little unfortunate. I thought that La Cornell was going to be short. She was obviously working at the farm.
Short priced or short of fitness?
Short in terms of fitness. I don't think the Florida Oaks was the goal with her. Like we've talked so many times about some of the Mark Cassie runners, including Teppan. It just felt like that was the kind of the comeback race she had been at the farm, and not down at Palm Meadows with the rest of the Cassie contingency, and so I just felt like she was going to be a little bit short. I think Florent probably moved a tad early in that situation and made it a little bit more of a challenge for her. But I was hopeful that Compelled was going to get up, and if not Compelled, the Daddy Horse, the Kenny McPeak, the four horse was going to take to the turf. And
Daddy's
and,
little darling, is that?
Daddy's little darling, yeah, and then the winner, obviously with a good setup,
55
came and picked up the pieces, yeah.
So the winner certainly had the best run with the runaway horse in there, and then you had Compelled making an early move, La Coronel making an early move. 55 was a horse I liked a lot in the race for under. Didn't quite expect that pace scenario to play out. Could have used it a little bit better if Compelled had been the one to get to the front and 55 was the hard-charging second. Did you have any thoughts on this race, Mike?
I'll just mention something about 55, and we've mentioned this on webinars. We've mentioned this, of course, on the podcast, you know, that Buff Bradley angle with Divisadero. 55 is a horse who ran quite well in her first start. I believe she broke her maiden in her second start. And Tommy Bush almost never wins. He's something like 1 for 100 in the last 5 years with first time starters.
He's a give him and a when race I, guy for sure.
Yeah, exactly. When I saw 55, I mean, she's by Get Stormy, right? Who was probably Tom Bush's last really good turf horse. I think it took 4 starts for Get Stormy to break his maiden. 55 broke her maiden in her second start. When I see horses like that for Tom Bush, who show so much talent early in their career, I take notice because I think they might be good. And so far, it seems like he's got a good one in 55.
Quick little bit of tournament talk. Mike posted a funny picture on the weekend after Jonathan had played Stanford in all three of his. It was the first race of a 12-race all-mandatory contest, and he took the 1-2 shot in the first leg on all three entries. And I was talking about confusing some out there in the Twitterverse. I was talking about what a brilliant move I thought this was. Simply because points that you get, the contest isn't real life. It's not like making a huge bet at 1-2 on a horse. When you're doing it in a contest with the limited amount of opportunities there are to score points, when you can get points that nobody else has, those points are worth more. Now, I was hoping I could use Jonathan as a poster boy for this, but instead, Bassam Stefan stepped up on DRF tournaments to be the poster boy because he, too, used Stanford in the contest that he was playing in to win a seat into the win contest in August. And in the end, the 520 he got in the first race on Stanford was the difference between winning $3,000 and winning zero. So I thought that illustrated my point pretty well. JK, obviously you're a fan of that strategy. How do you deal with it when you take a short price in a contest like that and the horse doesn't win? Is it just demoralizing to you?
Yeah, it's tough because if you use a 1-2 shot on everything, a lot more guys don't use the 1-2 and use other horses that don't have chances. And if they actually have a chance and win, you're kind of up a hill. So, but Mike unfairly didn't point out that in the next race at Gulfstream, I used a $10 horse on all three of my entries. So, I'm a big believer when it comes to these tournaments, when you're playing multi-entries, and you wrote a piece about it last week. I want to put both of my tickets into position so that I can use two horses that I like. I don't like liking a 4-1 shot and then using a 10-1 shot because he's 10-1. I want to use horses that I like. And so if I like a 4-1 or a 1-2 or whatever it is, I'm going to use them on both entries. I'm going to hope and I have the confidence that I'm right. And then when I get to a spot where I have two horses that I like, I can take both of them, but I'm taking them on equal tickets. There's nothing worse than having a ticket with $20 and one with $10, and then your second choice of a race that's 10-1 wins on your second entry, and then you kind of zigzag and you lose that $10 between your 20 and your 10. And so I like to try to get both into position where I can zig when I'm zigging and zagging. They're both moving up at the same time.
The split ticket situation is certainly the bane of many multiple entry contest player. There are ways you can try to avoid it. One theory to do that is to just keep your tickets the same through the first 2/3 of the contest and then spread out in the last third. Hopefully you're having a good day and then you just have a ton of leverage late. But I prefer the way that JK typically approaches it, where you're taking your strongest opinions, whether they're on favorites, whether they're on long shots, and you're putting those on multiple entries. And then in situations where your opinion is divided, you divide your entries there. Lots of good stuff happening on DRF tournaments, tournaments.drf.com. We have these new winner-take-all games with 5 players where the winner gets, I think, 500. Have you played in any of those yet, JK?
Yeah, there's a during the week, and I think what they're going to do is during the week they're going to do like 55. At least that's what it seems like they're doing. They're doing like $55 ones where the winner gets $250. And then on the weekend they're doing $100 ones where the winner gets $500. Until at least the traction gets rolling on them and they start filling, you know what I mean?
Have the games been filling? Have they been going so far? They're sort of getting...
I played in a $100 one and a $50 one, I think, this weekend. $100 on Saturday, $50 on Sunday, and didn't do well. But yeah, they filled.
Any success at all for you this weekend? I know you were involved with a bunch of head-to-heads against listeners. That must be fun, getting to play some of these folks that we know.
Yeah, no, yeah, Ruben, our guy Ruben that's out at Santa Anita, we started a little series of a best of seven, and I jumped out to a 2-0 lead, and then this weekend he tied it up 2-2, so we're even, and I'm sure we'll keep that going through the weekend. And then Elliot Honecker, I don't know if we talked about it on Friday or not, I think we did, but I was doing like a tutorial video, and I just threw in some picks for the tutorial video, and for whatever reason I forgot to change those when I played Elliot. I crushed Elliot that day with those terrible picks that weren't even mine. And then he's come back and beat me up a couple times in a row.
You could have just PayPal'd him the money, JK. I don't want to hear this moaning.
No, but the thing is that I sent him immediately after I noticed, after the first race was over, I said, look, these are the picks I was actually going to use. Just whatever happens, happens. I just wanted you to know that. So I would have won that day either way, which makes me feel a little bit better. But he beat me up pretty bad the other day. So I'm sure we'll get involved again this week. And it's a lot of fun. I love playing those head-to-heads. You just got to worry about one guy. And it's when that 20-1 shot that you would never play in your life hits, you got a really good shot of the guy you're playing not having him. And if he does have it, then he deserves to beat you.
Tip your hat to him or her if they do have it in that format, that's for sure. Quick question about biases. We had a question come in about all the biases there have been at Aqueduct this winter, and I've been following Aqueduct pretty closely, so I would concur that there have been several biased days. Brad Heil wants to know if we have theories about potential causes of biases to look out for, or if it's just the kind of thing you have to keep your eye out for. JK, I know I just threw the last question to JK, but I know he's more of a biased guy than Mike is, so we'll start with you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a lot of the things to look for. I haven't been following it enough. I think
you can answer
one of the biggest
generally,
things,
though, if not.
Yeah, I think weather. Yeah. I think weather changes are significant. Obviously, rain. Are important. So I would think that those are the main things. It's kind of a weather change. When it rains, there's a lot of movement in the surface with drainage and things like that. And so one part of the track can end up being deeper or not. So that's kind of how I would look at it. It would be the weather.
Here's what I'd like to see, because more than usual, we've seen days at Aqueduct this winter where the bias seems to change partway through the day, and I'm assuming that there's some track maintenance stuff going on. I would like to see where a track, every time they do maintenance during the day, they just announce it, because even if your eye is trained on one simulcast feed all day, which very few of our eyes are, you're still not necessarily going to see every time they harrow or do any kind of maintenance out there. Do you think that's realistic, Mike? Could we have a day where they, John Imbrial or Travis Stone comes on the loudspeaker and says, hey, so everybody knows, the tractors are harrowing after race four, or is that not something you'll ever see happening?
No, yeah, I don't see why they couldn't. If they felt like it was worthwhile information, it's easy enough to announce it. But, it also becomes a case of sometimes more information is not always best information. You might see that and make some assessments or assumptions about how the track is going to play going forward, which may or may not be correct. So it's like all information, I think it's good to note, but I wouldn't necessarily go overboard on having it change your opinions going forward, change how you're handicapping future races just because they brought the tractor out onto the track.
No, all I would say is if it's a day where it's been a pronounced inside bias, if I knew they were doing something to the racetrack, that would make me make me not bet on that assumption, which is sometimes the best bets are the ones you don't make, and I'd be sort of hoping that could be the case. Yeah, the weather's just been crazy in New York, which has definitely contributed to this. We've had some days. Friday, in fact, was one where the track is just kind of dead and slow, and you're seeing like these reverse variants. Track just can get weird. And some of that is racing all winter, especially in a winter where I got to imagine these incredible fluctuations in temperature we've had, where it'll be and this is not an exaggeration, 60 one day and 20 the next. It's mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying the track supers are doing anything wrong. That's got to be a very, very difficult situation. I think the best thing to do is, as great as it is to try to catch a bias while it's happening, to try to do your work after the fact, and if you can identify the days where you can confidently say there was a bias that this day from going back and looking at charts and figures and your own trip work, and then noting those days in your PPs for when those horses come back. That's probably the best info you're going to get out of that. Gentlemen, we've come to the end of the show. We do have time for a very quick closing thought, if either of you have one. I'm going to let that silence tell me that we are done, ladies and gentlemen.
No, I got a quick one. Congratulations to our buddy Eric Moomy for the UBC win.
Good point.
He's had a rough year, and I don't want to put too much of his business out in the streets, but he's had some health issues. He's been kind of rolling through the last, I don't know, it feels like maybe almost 18 months. And so I'm really glad to see that he was able to kind of get back out and that his health is going in the right direction, and he was rewarded with a good win. I know live money tournaments have sometimes been elusive for Eric. His style of play is one that he'll blow up a leaderboard one day with huge numbers, but then it's also he'll leave with zero. He's a kind of a win it all or go home guy. So congratulations to him. I'm glad he's feeling better and glad he got the win.
JK talking about the ultimate betting challenge. Eric was playing out at Santa Anita. I'm going to try to catch up with him today or tomorrow, get a piece in the form. It has been a rough year for Eric. Still was very active in online tournaments when he could, but great to see him back in the winner's circle in an on-site event. All right, that's all the time we have. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank all of you for listening, especially those of you listening live, presumably with Cheltenham in the background like me. We will be back on Friday. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.